Hello and welcome to the next in our series of basic policy debate instructional presentations. My name is Alfred C. Snyder. I'm the Edmund W. Lawrence Professor of Forensics at the University of Vermont. And joining me today we have Jackie Massey, debate coach at the University of Vermont, and outstanding intense debate guy.
Glad to be here.
Today we're going to talk about the counterplan. And the counterplan can be an incredibly important part of the negative strategy to win the debate. In some debates, you know, the affirmative has a pretty good position. There really is a problem. The status quo is really not dealing with it. And so the negative team could be up a tree. They're in great difficulty because they're not able to defend the status quo. The counterplan gives the negative another option. The counterplan is where the negative says, no, we shouldn't use your plan. That's not the right way to do it. We should adopt the negative counterplan instead. Here's a basic definition of a counterplan. A counterplan is a proposal made by the negative, which is a reasonable alternative to the affirmative plan. A proposal made by the negative, which is a reasonable alternative to the affirmative plan. Now, by proposal, we mean that the counterplan has a plan, just like the affirmative has a plan. And you can refer back to the guidelines we give for writing a plan in writing the plan for your counterplan. But also, the counterplan has to be a reasonable alternative to the affirmative. It has to be some reason to vote against the affirmative. And that will become very critical as we examine the basic position, the basic theoretical obligations the negative has when they offer a counterplan. Jackie, I was going to ask you, what is the relationship between the status quo and a counterplan usually in the debate?
Well, the counterplan, if you think about what you really want to get out of the counterplan, some people claim that the counterplan would have to be a non-topical alternative to the resolution, which we'll talk about in a moment. I think that what the counterplan does is you have to look and see what situation the judge is going to be put in. Before the counterplan is ever introduced into the debate, then the judge just says, do I vote for the affirmative plan, or do I actually just vote against the affirmative plan and stay with the status quo? What the counterplan does when you introduce the counterplan is it offers that critic a choice between one possible plan and another possible plan. And so with the counterplan, many times people don't stake out in the debate, does the critic, after looking at the counterplan, actually get to move on and then decide, well, is the affirmative plan good or not? And so with the counterplan, I think that it sets you up to where you put the judge in the, I guess, position of saying, I vote for this plan or I vote for the counterplan.
The counterplan will be presented by the negative pretty much exclusively in first negative constructive. I think it's debatable as to whether you can present a counterplan later, but most counterplans are presented in the first negative constructive, and as a novice debater using a counterplan, I would encourage you to do that. So the negative stands up in their first negative constructive speech. They say, we're going to offer a counterplan. Then they read the plan part of their counterplan, what it is they're proposing. And then there's a number of basic things that the negative has to do. And in covering those, that will provide the substance of most of the rest of what we're going to talk about today. Jackie, you mentioned that the first thing is that there's a question about whether the counterplan can be topical or not. And sometimes the negative will just say, well, the counterplan is not topical. And sometimes that's not such a big issue. Could you explain that to us?
Well, the idea of the counterplan having to be non-topical is relevant whenever the resolution is the focus of the debate. Because when you have a general claim or a general resolution, the affirmative is trying to supposedly prove the resolution true, and so when the negative tries to deny the resolution, they can't be doing anything that would prove the resolution true. So if their counterplan was topical, then it would show that the resolution would be true. So if the resolution is important to the debate, and to the if it is the conclusion of the affirmative argument, i.e., my specific example proves the general claim of the resolution true, then the then the counterplan would have to be non-topical. It would have to not support the truth of the resolution. It would have to deny the truth of the resolution. Now, the way that debate has evolved, being old school as I am, the way that debate has evolved is most affirmatives, after I think Mr. Bile got into this argument of whole resolution or subtopicality, it really allowed us to investigate what the affirmatives are doing. And most affirmatives claim that they parametrize from the resolution, that their plan is an example of the resolution, and that's what we have to debate, and just decide if their plan is true or false, not if it supports the resolution, or if the resolution is, in general, true or false. And I think the main reason that that occurs, that the affirmative wants to argue that, is because they're not liable to defend all other possible changes that are topical under the resolution. They're only liable to defend their one change. And so when the affirmative says plan is focused, then I think that opens the debate up more for the counterplan just to be something opposite than the plan. An alternative to the plan. Well, not opposite necessarily, but an alternative, something different than the plan. So for the then that's where the debate occurs, I think, is does the affirmative plan, is it trying to prove the resolution true? Is the resolution relevant to the debate? If it is, then the counterplan has to be non-topical. If the resolution is not relevant, if it only like sets a parameter to divide ground before we show up, then I think the topical aspect of the counterplan would be hard to justify.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, in most policy debates that we see today, and with many of the judges, the resolution isn't the focus, right? It's the plan that's the focus.
Correct.
So it's not so important that the counterplan be non-topical, but if you want to, you're usually safe to say it's not.
Yes.
It's safe for the negative to say it's not topical, but perhaps not essential.
Because it's a traditional debate argument, really, to say that counterplan must be non-topical, but that assumes, once again, the traditional res is focused part of the debate.
Okay. The second thing that the negative has to prove, or might want to prove, by the way, nothing's definite in debate, right? You can argue about anything.
It's all debated.
There are very few rules. The rules are what the wording of the topic is, the length of the speeches, and what team you're on, and that's it. Everything else can be debatable. What we're trying to teach you is the common arguments or the conventional wisdom, what most judges believe, because then you'll be able to appeal to their beliefs. Well, that having been said, let's go to that second thing, and that is that the counterplan has to be what we call competitive. In other words, you have to choose between the two. There's a competition going on between the affirmative plan and the counterplan. And so what happens is if the counterplan is an alternative to the affirmative plan, it's a reason to reject it. Let me give a simple example. Somebody says, here's my plan, we should go to the movies. And you say, here's my plan, we should go out to dinner. Now, there's no reason why going out to dinner should stop you from going to the movies. You could be able to go out to dinner and then go to the movies. Or you could go to the movies and go to dinner. The existence of the counterplan, go to dinner, is not a reason not to go to the movies. However, you can make arguments as to why they are. You can show why they're an alternative. For example, we don't have enough money to go to both, so I guess we'll have to choose one over the other. Or they both take place at the same time. Well, I guess we can't do both. What we're saying is the counterplan has to be a reason to reject the affirmative proposal. Otherwise, every time the affirmative stands up, the negative could have a proposal, we should have total nuclear disarmament. And they would probably win the debate because that would be of a very big advantage. But that's not what's important. It's why is the desire for nuclear disarmament a reason to vote against my plan to change educational procedures to improve academic achievement? So the question is, the counterplan needs to be an alternative. It needs to be a substitute for the affirmative. Now, the way we look and see if the counterplan is competitive is we ask ourselves, would it be better to adopt just the counterplan or to adopt both the affirmative plan and the counterplan at the same time? If you have to choose between the two, then it's competitive and it's a good debate argument. There are a couple of standard ways in which negative teams try to demonstrate that the counterplan is competitive.
One way that many people attempt to show that their counterplan is competitive is they argue that it's mutually exclusive, which has a lot to do with what Tuna was just talking about. Whenever you decide to either A, go to the movie, or B, go eat dinner, can you do them both at the same time or can you not? And, like, there are things such as time or money, and even in the debate world there are things like, can this policy coexist with this policy at the same time? And so you have to prove that your counterplan is mutually exclusive. In other words, whenever the affirmative team says, well, why can't I do my plan and do my counterplan? What's wrong with that? Why does that prove my argument true of my plan? You have to have an argument on why you don't want to do those two things at the same time. Why either they can't physically coexist, or why it's just not efficient, or not, as the next term is, looks at, net beneficial. And I think that really in counterplan theory, a lot of the concepts of what makes a competitive counterplan has really folded down the net benefits today. It's really based upon, is the counterplan by itself better than the affirmative plan, or the affirmative plan and the counterplan? And if you win that argument, then that's what makes your counterplan competitive, based upon the first idea that it's an alternative to the affirmative plan, and the second idea is that when you do the counterplan, it actually gets you more benefits than the affirmative plan. So the focus then is on net benefits. And what you have to understand is there are different ways to actually show you get net benefits. Like one way is you can show that your counterplan doesn't link to a disadvantage that the affirmative is going to talk about.
So the disadvantage, the counterplan doesn't link to it.
And then another one is maybe the idea that the counterplan solves the affirmative advantages better. That's another example. So you just have to get a little bit, just a little bit, to show that you get your counterplan solved a little bit better than the affirmative plan, and a little bit better than the, not necessarily solved, but it's a little bit better than the plan and the counterplan put together, which is what their perm would be. And you have to show that your counterplan is the best option.
Well, let me give you an example. Is this what you're saying? If you showed that if you adopted the counterplan by itself, you'd get $1.01, right? But if you adopted the counterplan and the affirmative at the same time, you'd just get $1.
Right.
You definitely want to do just the case, even though it's only worth 1 cent. 1 cent is something.
Yeah.
But as long as the counterplan by itself is a little bit better, then you could win the debate with your counterplan, right?
Yeah, that's where a lot of people really overdo their counterplans, is they think they have to get some large, overwhelming net benefit to say the word, but you really don't. All you really need is something that makes it a little bit better, because the critic is at a forced choice type of scenario where they go plan or counterplan. And if you can persuade them that there's a little nudge better with the counterplan than the plan, then that's the reason that they would vote for you.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, quite often that's a disadvantage. The negative will offer a counterplan to the affirmative that doesn't cause the disadvantage they're arguing against the affirmative. So basically, what the counterplan allows the negative to do is to say, the affirmative identifies the problem, we address that problem with their counterplan, but we address it in a superior way because we don't cause this disadvantage that they cause. Federalism, for example, is a pretty good example of that. The state's counterplan says, have the states do it, and the advantage is that doesn't get the federalism disadvantage.
That's a very common way to argue a counterplan, is that your net benefit is actually also a disadvantage to the affirmative plan, and that way you have the option of, if you actually don't want to stick with your counterplan, you still have a disadvantage to the affirmative plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are really the main two, mutual exclusivity and net benefits. But as you said, net benefits is the most popular and most commonly used. But we don't just want to tell you about the good ways of competition. We just want to warn you about some other kinds of competition that negatives will try to sneak past you, and how you should keep that in mind and be able to answer it. One is, sometimes the negative will say that our counterplan is competitive because it's philosophically competitive. The philosophy embodied by the counterplan is different than the philosophy embodied by the affirmative plan, and you can't adopt two conflicting philosophies at once, so the counterplan is competitive.
And that one, actually, I was thinking about this, that one kind of works well with the critique argument, maybe, if you could figure out how to make that, you might be able to argue the philosophical competition with the critique mm-hmm. argument. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, that's a really hard argument.
Right. In the real world of policymaking, it never stops anyone from doing contradictory things. We, for example, urge young people not to smoke, but we have agricultural subsidies for tobacco. So, you know, we tell people not to have guns, and the police have lots of them. So what do you know? There are some other different approaches to competition. One is topical competitiveness. And you wanted to say something about that.
Well, that is really what I discussed earlier is if you can make the argument, I guess, that the topic or the resolution is important to the debate, then you can force the counterplan to have to compete with the topic and not necessarily have to compete with the affirmative plan. And one way you could actually do that is argue that the resolution divides ground, and even though you're only on a small part of your ground, that doesn't mean that they get to come over and intrude on your ground just because you're not taking up all of your ground in your 1AC. And so that's a way you could argue it has to be competitive on a topical level.
Mm-hmm. One of the other topicality standards you might hear is the one of redundancy, and that's what redundancy. Don't want to be redundant. If you're repetitiously redundant, you're repulsively repugnant. I guess that commits the fallacy I'm talking about. Redundancy is where you don't want to do the same thing twice. For example, if there was a disease spreading in your city, there probably is a disease spreading in your city, you might want to get vaccinated against that disease. But it wouldn't do you any good to get vaccinated twice or vaccinated 40 times, because then it would make your arm hurt. The redundancy argument says that because the counterplan solves for the affirmative, solves for the problem they identify, then that we don't need the affirmative, so we can just forget it. Well, the problem with that is that it assumes that the counterplan solves 100% of the time. And that's very rarely true. And I'll give you an example. If you are having sexual relations and you don't want to get pregnant, you could use a form of birth control. But it would probably be better if you would use two forms of birth control, since neither are 100% effective. If there was a disease spreading in your city and there were two possible vaccinations you could use, one was effective 60% of the time and one was effective 80% of the time, you'd want to take both. So redundancy doesn't work very well because there are very few proposals that solve 100% of any problem. Jackie, the main affirmative response to counterplans in the area of competition is represented by one of our most interesting vocabulary words, and that is permutation. And in debate, we just say perm. Now, we're not talking about making your hair curly. We're talking about a permutation. And the basic notion of a permutation is where you try to restructure things so that they fit together. How are permutations used in modern debate?
Well, there are a couple of different ways in which you can try to test a counterplan with a permutation. The first way is what we call a logical permutation. In other words, can we go to the store and go eat at the same time? That's a very logical permutation. Now, the argument that really is used to test that logical permutation is the permutation whole plan inclusive and whole counterplan inclusive? In other words, if it includes all the plan and all of the counterplan, it's considered a logical permutation.
And we could do both.
And then you show that you could actually do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to reemphasize for people that when the affirmative shows that we could do both, then the counterplan is no longer a reason to vote for the negative. It's not a reason to reject the affirmative.
Right.
So by demonstrating that we could do both, you defeat the counterplan absolutely 100%.
You prove that it's not a substitute or a forced alternative between the affirmative and the counterplan. The way that people test if the perm is good or bad, just to say this at the top before, is they talk about is it net beneficial or not. And so sometimes when you make your perm, then you want to show why your permutation of doing the plan and the counterplan together is better than doing just the counterplan alone. The second type of permutation is a temporal perm. Also, it's called a delay permutation. What this basically says is that we should do maybe the plan now and the counterplan a little bit later, or do the counterplan now and the plan a little bit later, and argue that if one's implemented now and one a little bit later, that you still get some net benefits out of doing that, and also that it's logical or that it's possible that you could do them that way. And of course, the argument against the delay perm is the idea that that doesn't test the true coexistence of the two policies, because it tests them in different temporal time periods, and that's not what a permutation is about. The third is the partial permutation, what some people also denote as the intrinsicness perm. And this is where maybe you only use part of the plan and all of the counterplan, or all of the counterplan and part of, and or all of the plan and part of the counterplan. And what you do is, whenever you make a permutation in a debate, you have to say what your permutation is. You can't just say perm, do all of plan and all of counterplan. You have to say perm, do what the plan would do, and say that, and then say, and do what the counterplan would do. Because a lot of people have moved to where they want to see the permutations written down. Because of the intrinsicness perm, people aren't just doing the whole plan and the whole counterplan. They're doing leaving parts of the plan out or parts of the counterplan. And so people are demanding that you write your permutation down. And also, if you're going to make the permutation strategically, you should write it down, because that's your way of trying to win the argument that the perm would be more net beneficial than doing the counterplan alone.
So for those three kinds of permutations, the logical permutation is you say you can do the plan and the counterplan and do them at the same time. The temporal or time permutation would say, first let's do one and then let's do the other one a little later. Just not at the same time, but just a little later. And the third one is to say, well, we'll take part of the affirmative and plan and part of the counterplan, and we'll restructure it as some kind of new critter, right? And that'll be the permutation that we advocate. So those are three different ways. By the way, the third alternative, the restructuring permutation, the intrinsicness permutation, is not accepted as much by judges.
No, and you still have to make that argument and say and point it out that it's not whole plan inclusive or it's not whole counterplan inclusive. And the reason that it's considered illegitimate in some ways is because when you vote for the affirmative, you're voting for the whole plan. Or when you vote for the counterplan, you're voting for the whole counterplan. And there's no vote at the end of the debate that votes for just part of the plan or just part of the counterplan.
You get a vote affirmative.
Right, because the permutation is only a test. It's not an actual plan that someone else is bringing out into the debate. It's considered just a test. Though some people get into the argument that they advocate the perm, and that's something else that has to be debated.
Okay. So watch out for perms coming to a debate near you soon. Now, I wanted to mention some of the things that people often forget about the counterplan, that people will present a counterplan, but you need to make sure that to do some of the other things that you would do whenever you have a plan. If you present a counterplan, you probably need to have solvency evidence. You need to say the counterplan will work, right? The counterplan will solve part of the problem that's being identified. The counterplan may also have an advantage, or a different advantage that the affirmative doesn't even have. Well, not only does the counterplan solve the problem the affirmative identifies, but it also has these other good effects. Another option for the affirmative is they can look at the counterplan and say, well, we think the counterplan is a really bad idea. This counterplan would cause this disadvantage. So the affirmative can actually offer disadvantages against the negative counterplan, and that would be a reason why it wouldn't be net beneficial and a reason why you would want to reject it. So don't forget that when you present the counterplan, you also need to show that it works and that the affirmative might have disadvantages against you.
I think against the counterplan, the perm is one strategic advantage when you're arguing against the counterplan, but I think running a disadvantage to the counterplan really puts the negative team in a bind as far as them having to decide what arguments they want to continue to extend into the debate. So putting a disad on every counterplan is always a good strategy.
Mm-hmm. Jackie, it seems like the most popular strategy now in terms of using counterplans in policy debate is that a team will have a pair of arguments, a counterplan and a disadvantage that they use together in a strategic way. How would you advise novice students to go about using that strategy since it is so popular and effective?
One way you can do that is find a disadvantage that you like a lot that you think links to most affirmative teams, and figure out if there's a counterplan you could argue that would not link to that position, and also if there's a way you could solve that harm that the plan doesn't do, then I think that's the most effective. You mentioned federalism earlier, and I think that that's a very common strategy, argue that federal action undermines federal power, or federal action undermines state power, and strong federal government bad. And you could argue the affirmative plan is federal action, so that undermines state power, and that's bad. But you can also argue if we do the counterplan, which is state action, then we get all the benefits of not doing federal action, plus it's all the benefits of not doing federal action are disadvantages to the affirmative. Mm-hmm.
And you also solve the affirmative problem. If the affirmative is saying, for example, that we need, that we should have security standards to make schools a safer place, then the negative counterplan could be, let's have states impose security standards, but at the same time, they solve the affirmative problem, but they don't have the harms of federal.
And you can also argue the solvency detriment between states and federal, and argue states solve better, federal doesn't solve, federal fails, states don't have money, federal does have money. With the current college debate topic, a very important argument that people are utilizing is the consultation counterplan. And they'll argue that implementing plan makes Russia scared, whichever country you utilize, and then they'll run a counterplan saying we consult Russia. And those two work very well together, too. And then they argue that if you do the counterplan, you get all the advantages of the affirmative plan, plus you reduce the risk that Russia's going to get mad and bad things are going to happen in Russia.
Let's finish then by just talking about common errors that novice debaters make. Common errors when they make on the affirmative, when a counterplan is used against them. What are some of those?
I think one common error that always happens in debate is, first of all, people forget to make the permutation in the 2AC, and you have to try to do that, because against a counterplan, if it's put together very well, you have to have some what we call offense against the counterplan. You just can't let it go by. And then the other thing is, like I said, you need to have some way to argue that the counterplan is bad in some way. I think a big mistake that I notice when people argue a counterplan or have a counterplan argued against them is nobody stakes out what the judge's role is. If the judge looks at the plan and says, the plan's okay, looks at the counterplan and goes, the counterplan's not as good as the plan, does the judge then say, all right, well, forget the counterplan now. Is the plan good? And a lot of debaters on the affirmative allow the negative to have that double-edged sword, to where if they win the counterplan, they win the debate, and if they don't win the counterplan, then it's ignored, and then the affirmative case is actually tested. And it should be either plan or counterplan. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want to vote for the counterplan, then you've got to vote for the plan.
I guess the reverse side of the affirmative error is the negative error, though, that I want to point out, in that the negative, often novice debaters, negative debaters using a counterplan will forget to answer the affirmative's permutation.
Yes.
And if you don't answer the affirmative's permutation on the negative, your counterplan will go away. Once your counterplan is not a reason to vote against the affirmative, it is gone out of the debate round. And so once you must answer the affirmative's permutation argument when you're defending your counterplan.
Yeah,
any other big errors?
I guess the one thing that's important is the idea of what is dispositional and what's conditional, because a lot of people don't really know what the difference is.
What is the difference?
Conditional says that if there's any time in the debate I don't want to defend my counterplan, that it's ignored in the decision calculus. And
dispositional
says that the only time in the debate when I can allow my counterplan to be ignored and say I don't want it anymore is if they prove that by itself it's a bad alternative. Mm-hmm. In other words, there are disadvantages or the counterplan isn't as advantageous as the affirmative plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you're not supposed to be able to allow a counterplan to leave the debate if it's just proven as a bad idea. But that's very debatable, of course.
Some of the most sophisticated arguments you'll be involved in when you debate are about the counterplan and about permutations and about competitiveness. It's a great opportunity for you to flex your mental muscles by figuring out how things get put together. Thanks a lot for watching. Thanks a lot, Jesse. We'll see you down the road. We'll see you too. Stay with it. Keep debating. Don't give up.